Good morning and welcome into the show. Thanks for tuning in. It is Daniel Wormick coming to you live from the Dream Imagine 8 Sports Studios. Tuesday, September the 24th, 8 a.m. on the East Coast, 7 in the Central Time Zone, 5 out West in all time zones around the world. Thanks for tuning in this Tuesday morning. Yesterday, we went through a tweet thread that I posted this weekend. And had some good back and forth. Still having some traction. It's a sad state of affairs, to be honest, where we are. You don't have to be a soccer expert to fix the U.S. Soccer Federation. I mean, obviously that helps. The biggest key when you're looking at a situation like the U.S. Soccer Federation, the biggest key in all of this, and it's one that I don't think is talked about enough. I mean, we talk about we need soccer people. And Steve Jobs, there's a clip I posted yesterday of Steve Jobs in relation to having quote unquote soccer people run the U.S. Soccer Federation. But it's really when you get to the essence of, you know, what is the what is really necessary? What is, you know, what is really required in that scenario? It's not as much about the person being a soccer person. Now, obviously, like I said, I do think having a knowledge and a background in that, definitely helps. But what I would say is that even more important than that is that you got to be a great leader, because you could be a really good soccer person and not be a great leader. And when you are looking at a situation like the U.S. Soccer Federation, you need great leadership. I mean, bottom line, the way Carlos Cordero sold the Athlete Council on electing him was that he was going to be that leader. He knows and he admits, I am not a soccer expert. What I'm going to do is staff. I'm going to surround myself with soccer people. And he positioned himself as that leader. But in the time that we've seen since the 2018 election, it's been a year and a half, I've not seen leadership. I've seen talking points. I've seen committees. I've seen corporate speak. I've seen layers of management. Those moves in and of themselves are not leadership moves. They're just moves. They could be leadership moves, but my point is that on their face, they are not leadership moves. That's where we're suffering. That is where we need change and progress to occur, because we're going nowhere fast. I mean, to be honest, yesterday, the FIFA best, the best FIFA awards were handed out. The U.S. was represented very well on the women's side. Let's make that point. Let's make that clarification, because there's nothing really to show on the men's side. On the best FIFA men's player, Lionel Messi. I know all of you Ronaldo lovers out there are disappointed. I'm going to say this, and I'll say it again and again and again. Messi is the best. He is the greatest of all time. And he's really not won the awards he should have won. And a lot of it is down to Ronaldo and Ronaldo's marketing. Ronaldo is nowhere near the player that Messi is. So you can hate me all you want. So justice was served yesterday in that regard. Leo Messi, best FIFA men's player. The best FIFA women's player was named, and that was Megan Rapinoe. I don't have a big argument with that. I don't think she had the World Cup that a lot of people claim she had. I didn't actually think she was great, but she was great in moments that counted. And so for that, I don't have a big, big issue with that. I really think Rose Lavelle is headed for that award if she continues her form, and others will be battling for that as well. The best FIFA men's coach, Jurgen Klopp. No argument here. Phenomenal year last year in the Premier League, won the Champions League. To me, it's that really is no surprise. I do think honorable mention should go to Erik ten Hag, Ajax manager, who had Ajax playing some brilliant football last year. The best FIFA women's coach, Jill Ellis. Not a big fan of her tactics, but you can't argue her success on the field and her personal management skills. She did a great job with that team. And you can, I don't know if you saw this, she talked about that instead of calling their non-starters, their bench players, reserves, they called them game changers. And you may think that's a little powder puff or whatever, but you know, the truth of the matter is, that's part of the man management. That's part of that personal management skill that that she displayed, and it definitely paid off. The best FIFA men's goalkeeper, Alison Becker. To me, that was that's a very good good call. Best FIFA women's goalkeeper, Sari van Vandeval. She was very good as well in the Women's World Cup. You can look up all of these awards. You just Google, you know, the best FIFA football awards. Those are some of the top awards that were named. If you the FIFA World 11 included Alisson, De Ligt, Marcelo, Sergio Ramos, Virgil van Dijk, Frankie de Jong, Eden Hazard, Luka Modric, Cristiano Ronaldo, Kylian Mbappe, and Lionel Messi. What I'm struggling with in that is Man City had an amazing season last year. No De Bruyne, no Bernardo Silva. I think they're a little short on some Man City representation because they were excellent. So, like I said, you can look this up and find all these different awards. they're worth taking a look at. You know, if you're interested in that kind of stuff. So that took place yesterday. And like I said, all is right and well with the world when it comes to those awards, because Messi is simply amazing. And it was great to see that yesterday. Coming up after the break, we have Colton Bryant coming to join the show. Our sponsor this half hour is Ductic Brand, D-U-K-T-I-G brand.com. Use promo code DWSHOW to get 10% off of your order. I've been telling you about this new t-shirt they have. It's really cool. It's really fire. You should check it out. Also, look at their notebooks. You can get them personalized, all of that. Use promo code DWSHOW to get 10% off of that order at ducticbrand.com. We'll be right back with Colton Bryant right after this. Tuning in this Tuesday, September the 24th. Pleased to be joined by the head coach of Columbia State University, Colton Bryant. Colton, welcome to the show. How are you this morning?
I'm great. Yourself?
I am doing well. The FIFA Best Awards were yesterday, Best FIFA Awards, whatever you want to call them, and I'm a big Messi fan. Feel like in the last few years he's not gotten his due, and so it was nice to see him pick up that award. I know Virgil van Dijk had a great year last year, but I think the award went where it needed to go, so I was happy with that. So I'm having a good morning. How was your morning so far?
It's been good. I actually was pulling for van Dijk. I'm a big Liverpool supporter.
Hey, that's good. Liverpool's my second favorite team, so I wouldn't have been mad if Van Dijk won. He did have a great year last year, and there's no doubt about it. My main issue is I feel like Cristiano Ronaldo's marketing team is better than anyone on the planet, and as long as he didn't win, I was fine with either of those guys winning. So I would have been fine, if Van Dijk would have won, and totally would have understood if he would have won, because he had an outstanding year and is an outstanding player.
But Messi is different.
He's an alien, man. It is, I think one of the things. Before we move on, I think one of the things as Barcelona is my all-time, that's my club. I do, Liverpool's my second favorite. I like them in the Premier League and all of that. But one of the things watching Barcelona over the last few years is the fact that I think Valverde is a terrible coach. Great guy from all accounts, but just I don't think he's a very good coach. And to watch what Messi's had to deal with for the last couple of years in terms of the team structure and play, how much he's had to carry the load and still found a way to be successful despite the tactics and management, to me, has not gotten talked about enough. Where I feel like, you know, if he had a quality manager still around, I think it would have been more clear for a lot of people, because Barcelona hasn't looked, as a team, haven't really looked very good for the last few years. They've won really despite, the management, which is, you know, really and truly, I mean, you know, it's kind of the same thing you see in American soccer. Yeah, a lot of teams, especially in youth soccer, win despite the coaching, just because the players are better, you have more talent, deeper roster, or maybe a kid's bigger, faster, stronger, what have you. Not necessarily because of the way the team's set up. So, that's been my observation, and like I said, I'd been fine either way, but you know, I'm definitely happy that Messi got some recognition on that. So anyway,
I mean, he is the best player.
Absolutely. There's no doubt. And all you Ronaldo haters can send me hate mail. It's fine. I'll laugh and read every one of them. So anyway, so tell us, Colton, a little bit about your background. Kind of, how did you get connected with a game, and at what point did you realize, hey, I want to become a coach?
So I guess it started when I went to college. I had torn my ACL the summer before I got in. I played semi-pro in Rocket City United in Alabama. And then, I tore my ACL, and then during my recovery, my ACL tore again. And that was my third ACL tear, 'cause I had one in high school on the same leg. And my coach basically said, hey, you should start coaching, and gave me a team. And I'm going to be honest, I didn't think I would like it. I really didn't like kids at the time. But so I started doing that, and little by little, I started liking it. And then basically I became the student assistant at Martin Methodist. And then I went off to Argentina while I was at school. I got to snoop around and work at Newell's Old Boys, which is actually, it's funny, we spoke about Messi. That's where Barcelona bought him from. That was a really good experience. I was in his hometown. And then push came to shove. We, in 2013, we won a national title at Martin Methodist, which obviously is a blast. And then, I don't know, things just sort of went up from there. I started working for a tournament company called Premier Soccer Services. We ran the biggest youth international tournament in the country, and it was called Copa Rayados, and we were connected to Monterrey Rayados out of Mexico. And it just so happened, when I met Nicholas, the academy director, he was from Argentina, and he loved that I worked in Argentina, so then he let me come do a little bit at Monterrey in Mexico. And then I was helping do international games, so we had the Columbus crew play Los Tiburones Veracruz. So we brought both first teams in and did a big exhibition match. And then I think right after that, after I graduated, I moved off to South Florida and worked in a academy down there. And this, I guess it would have been last year, my mother had gotten a bit sick. So I moved back home just to be closer. And I came to the local school and asked them if, you know, they'd be interested in starting a women's program, because I had noticed that there were more numbers for the men than the women in terms of athletics, and there's more women than men in the school. So it was going to be a Title IX issue. So I basically brought it up, and we fixed it by starting the women's soccer team.
So you fix it by starting a soccer team. So you didn't just come to coach, you started an entire program. Yes. At Columbia State. Now, where is Columbia State located?
Just south of Nashville in Columbia, Tennessee.
Okay. So you are just south of Nashville, and
we have a campus in Franklin.
Okay.
What area?
Right. So you recognize that here's an opportunity. I'm going to take the bull by the horns. I'm going to start this thing from scratch, and I'd like to be its coach. What was kind of your your first call? Who's your first call to? What are you trying to get together to get a program launched? Because so many times you talk to someone and they're saying, okay, well, I took this coaching job and this is what I was looking at, but you were beyond just taking a coaching job. You were building an entire program. So who was your first call? What were you feeling like, okay, these are the things I need to take care of first before I can even, you know, put on my coaching hat?
Well, the first thing was obviously I had to go to the athletic director and explain why I think this is a good area. And then I had to, basically I had to write a mock budget and minimize, because like as the first year, they weren't going to necessarily fund it like they do the other teams. So I had to do a mock budget and see what would be realistic in terms of our travel, in terms of, because you don't have many teams, like the first JUCO, because we're a junior college, the first JUCO team started would have been 2 years ago in Tennessee. So then we would have been following that year. And then, so there's not many teams around us to play is what I'm getting at, outside of four-year schools. So we had to figure out where all we could travel, which so you've got Mississippi, you've got Georgia, but Alabama doesn't even really have any JUCO soccer. So it was very, and Kentucky doesn't either. So it was very difficult in figuring out how to travel and get enough games and whatnot. So I had to beg a lot of teams to come to us. But also we were only approved with, I think it was really weird, because I actually accepted a job in California the day before Columbia State called and said that they got approved. Do I want the job? And so I had to call the guys in California and tell them that I was going to stay and start this program. So I had 3 months from the day that Columbia State was approved to put together the whole program, have 24 players minimum. I had to have 24 players to meet the numbers for, you know, Title IX is what I was starting it for. And then from there, I don't really know what my first call was. I kind of just started doing. Like every day, I was just doing whatever fell on my plate. I wanted to try and get a schedule put together. Everybody already had, you know, games scheduled. So yeah, literally, I called so many teams and only got 8 games. So that was a difficult one. And then I had to hold tryouts. And, you know, really, it was the whole tryouts and pray. And oddly enough, I got very lucky. I got a lot of very, very good players that I didn't think would come at a tryout that, you know, is 3 months before August 1st, which is day one of preseason. So then from there, it was just, you know, praying it went well. And then finally, when you get on the field, you just have to, you work with what you got. And I'm going to be honest, I had a lot more to work with than I could have expected.
So you not only have to start a program, it's like, hey, yeah, we're going to let you start the program. It starts in 3 months. Like here's your on ramp. Where did you go? I mean, you said you did tryouts. Where did you go to get, you know, the word out for people to come? If it's only the second JUCO program in the state of Tennessee, where were you going? Who were you calling to try to get the word out about this opportunity opening up at Columbia State?
So I had worked a lot in Tennessee. So the first thing I did was go back to my tournament background, which was I used to host the Tennessee Cup, the Alabama Cup. So there's a lot of tournaments around here that a lot of coaches would have known me through being the director. And so I was emailing. I mean, I have a database of over 3,000 teams just within Tennessee, from ages, you know, all different ages, but I made sure I emailed every age, even though if it was a coach for a U9 team, I bet you that he knows kids that are older. And then I went to the paper, and then I put it all over all social media platforms. And then, like I said, after that, I just kind of prayed and hoped that, things happened. And what you'll find is around here, there's not a lot of, I mean, you've got your Tennessee Soccer Club, which obviously is the big club around here, but there, outside of that, there's not any massive clubs. So what you find is there's actually a lot of good players around this area that maybe don't get the exposure that, you know, maybe they need in order to get picked up. So we were able to pick up a lot of good players just through the players betting on themselves by coming to tryouts. The players, it's really hard nowadays to find the players that say, well, especially when they've been told their whole life that, you know, you go to a four-year school, whereas JUCO hadn't existed here. It's very hard to find the players that are okay to say, you know what, I don't mind doing this because I'm good enough to go to a bigger school. And we actually, like, my goalkeeper is phenomenal. She had zero offers out of high school. And just after five games with us, she had around seven or eight offers. I mean, she's unbelievable. And then, we had a few, like a few attacking players that got lucky on I went to Nashville and did a training session for one of the high schools and then picked up one of their players who was really, really good. She actually just scored a really nice free kick this weekend for us. But yeah, no, I just was calling everybody I knew to call and just hoping everything went as best as possible. But I think around here, the soccer community is actually quite strong. And so everyone was supporting it. In fact, we set the record at Columbia State's, I guess, athletic department for most fans in attendance. And it was in our first game. We had over 375 fans.
So you start a program in 3 months, you're like in the, instant dinner aisle at the grocery store trying to throw things together and get a meal on the table, really quick, with launching your soccer program. And the thing I keep hearing from you is that, you're like, I sent all these emails and I talked to these people and then I went, you know, you hustled. You went out and hustled and worked. That kind of effort is what we need more of in American soccer. I just feel like too many are resting on their laurels. You know, things have gotten so easy. Right. You know, and yet here you were, you're like, okay, I got to get this off the ground. I got to make this happen. And got out and hustled and you were rewarded with that by giving some opportunities to some young ladies that didn't really have an opportunity prior to that. In the case of, you know, bringing in these players, being a junior college, I'm assuming they can be in your program. Is it 2 years? Is that the max?
Yes.
So when they come in, can they leave after 1 year and go straight to a 4-year school?
Yes. So we make sure that we go through all options with them. First and foremost, I would like them to graduate. It's the reason we even have athletics at school is athletics actually boost graduation rates higher than any other area. So we want to make sure they graduate. However, I'm not naive. I know if I was in their position, how I would want. So for example, let's say my goalkeeper, she did get a lot of offers and she's one of the ones that I was saying, hey, you know, these are some offers that you might actually want to take. And I actually thought she was going to. But after the University of Florida had said that she could be a good number two or three for them, it kind of lit a fire under her. She wanted to be the number one. And she told me that the only way she would leave is if Florida offered her. So she decided to sort of, you know, just stay with us, which helped. But at the same time, I was worried. So I went ahead and signed another number one. So here I am this year. I have two number ones. So we have to flip flop around. Otherwise, you know, obviously I could lose the other one. But they're allowed to leave after 1 year. But we want to evaluate and make sure it's the right time. I would hate that they leave and then find that they don't like maybe the coach that they're going to play for. They don't like the area of the school. So we always want to make sure that they understand more about the recruiting process, because what I'm finding is some of the players we get, we only get them because they didn't know how to start their recruiting process. So they're good enough to play at a 4-year. They just didn't really know the right steps. They thought maybe it was like American football where all the coaches were at all the high school games. And that's not necessarily that's not necessarily how it works. I mean, if you're not a part of ECNL or a DA, a lot of four-year schools are, you know, they're too, they think they're too good to look at you. So if they didn't go out and email all these coaches on the side, then they don't necessarily get the offers or looks that they should have. So we try and educate them on that. We have individual meetings with each player. And then first and foremost, we kind of make sure that, yes, we know you want to play at a program, but does it fit you academically? It's crazy how many girls just look at it and go, oh my goodness, this is a D1 offer. And I'm like, yes, but they don't even have journalism. And that's what you want to do. So it's trying to make sure that they're academic. And some players will try and say, I can change my major because blah, blah, blah. I'm like, you really need to evaluate that and make sure, because that's kind of your life. You know, you can, everyone has the dream, I know, of wanting to play D1. But is it worth throwing away your dream of being a professional in the field that you're, you know, studying? And so there's a lot of factors to go into that. But yes, they can leave after 1 year. I would like them to graduate, but if it's the right offer and it's the right time, I would never hold them.
So you just described one of the inefficiencies in the American ecosystem, and that is in the scouting of players. And this is not exclusive to you know, female players. This goes for male players as well. When you're looking at scouting, it's oftentimes, hey, we're going to look at the DA, the ECNL, and you know, we're not really going to do the things that you did to hustle to get around. We're just going to be like, hey, if they're not there, then it's not worth it, which leaves a massive inefficiency in the market. Gary Vaynerchuk, business guy, I don't know if you follow, yeah, any of his stuff, but he's always talking about, you know, the arbitrage. And it's that space in a market or in a field or in an ecosystem that is available to be exploited. And I think that space is ginormous. And I think that you started tapping into that space. As you described, you know, that there were these players who didn't realize what needed to happen from a recruiting standpoint to get the opportunities that they wanted. And the market, you know, has this giant inefficiency in that there's basically one kind of path that these colleges are going to go look at. And, you know, so if you are playing in high school or you're not playing in a club that has DA or ECNL, you are on the outside looking in. As a coach, you know, and you're in a junior college program, it seems to me you found a pretty good niche in exploiting that arbitrage, opening up opportunities to players, and then, you know, obviously getting them positioned as much as you can help them, you know, to move on to a 4-year school when that time is right, either after 1 or 2 years. What did you find after going through one season and getting ready for another season, your second season, in terms of lessons learned? Did you feel like after going through it that you had a better idea of where to go and find the players? Did players start coming to you? How did that process change, and what lessons did you learn after going through a year, not just having 3 months to get your program off the ground?
I think a lot of what I learned was I didn't think it would be too difficult to attract, you know, higher level players because we were in junior college. Because here in Tennessee, we have something called the Tennessee Promise. And it's an initiative that the government, basically, if you go to these meetings in high school and you have a good GPA, you get your first 2 years automatically free. And then if I add athletic aid on top of that, it stats. And since we're a Division I JUCO, but we don't have, we're not allowed to have dorms for some reason. So we don't really have housing, but a retired doctor of the college actually, basically, he built a neighborhood across the street, and we actually can scholarship, and you can even go on the NJC, which is our governing body, NJCAA, and you can actually click like housing on your scholarship. So I'm allowed to give, if I wanted to give a player $1,000, I'm allowed to give them $1,000 and they can use that towards their rent across the street. So I actually thought it wouldn't be too difficult to attract some of the, you know, better players. And then what I found, what I learned through the recruiting process again was, you know, there's a stigma for some reason that it wouldn't be as competitive enough for them. And because I guess it was a first year program, you know, last year, and then they're looking at the whole idea of, you know, these kids have never heard of junior college soccer. So it's fighting that stigma. So what I did first and foremost was try and find maybe an international player or two that come from very, very, very good areas to go ahead and open the eyes of some of these players. So that's what we did. We actually signed a midfielder that used to play in Manchester City's DA. She played in Stoke City's DA as well. And then we signed a Canadian girl from the Toronto Blizzards, which is historically, well, actually, no, they are the best academy to get out of Canada. So they always, I mean, most of their players go Division One. In fact, the player that we picked up was supposed to be on a full ride to Division One, and then something happened with her NCAA clearinghouse, and she wasn't able to get cleared. So we ended up picking her up, and she's also a Guyana women's national team player. So then now when, well, after we got those, you know, committed and nearly signed, because obviously can't sign until November, I was then able to go to some of the bigger high schools, the bigger clubs, and talk to players. And when they say, well, you know, I just don't know if it's good enough, I'll be like, well, have you ever played on a national team or a professional development academy? And they said, no, obviously. And I said, well, we have two that have. And are you too good for that? And so that sort of changed their mind. And I used to be an athlete too. So I know athletes have a competitive mindset. And I always just told them, you know, you don't have to settle for an offer because it's an offer and you think that it's going to be, you know, you think it's how your friends are going to view it and blah, blah, blah. I said, if you think you're good enough and you want to bet on yourself, I promise you, I'll get you the exposure you need. I think you're good enough or I wouldn't be talking to you. But if you think you're good enough, you'll take this opportunity, because if you wanted to go to the University of North Alabama, if you want to go to the University of Belmont, you know, all these D1 schools around us, Lipscomb, Vanderbilt, all that, I said, it's possible that you go to a school now that may be 10 hours away and you're on a minimal offer. One, you're going to find yourself maybe homesick. Two, you're going to, you don't know the coach too well. Obviously, you don't know me too well either, but if you don't like it here, at least you're on the full ride automatically. So that was sort of the approach we took. And the only thing I learned was I wasn't giving ourselves enough credit in terms of we can go for the top players. My issue was, you know, I had the self battle of, well, how are they going to view this? How are they going to view that? And in reality, I learned all I needed to do was tell them what the plan is, what we want to do. And if they want to be a part of it, great. If you don't, I'm not going to convince you. We only want players that want to be here. And what we're finding is a big turn. Like this year for 2020, we've gotten really, really good commits. It also helps that we're the number one nursing program in Tennessee. One of the only programs in the country that had 100% NCLEX pass rate. So, and a lot of girls want to go into nursing. So it helps us a lot in terms of our academics, because we're very academically strong at Columbia State. We're actually, I think, 60th overall JUCO in the country.
In the lessons that you learned, the opportunities there to me that you're taking advantage of to, you know, define an arbitrage in the market and bring in these players. What in launching this program, obviously there's not this long track record. It's not a North Carolina women's program that is storied in over decades and national titles. To where now it's basically just send a letter and you have a player's attention because it's got the UNC logo on it. You're starting out still. I mean, you're still in the early stages. Right. When you look at this in a historical perspective, What has the reaction been from the players that you've already brought in and then the players that you're looking to bring in? How has their mentality either changed or how has their response been to becoming part of the program and experiencing, Columbia State, as well as specifically your program, where maybe in the past, you know, like you were describing earlier, the thought process is, you know, four-year school. How has that impact, been shown with your players?
Honestly, it's been phenomenal. I know it's an eye roller for a lot of people, but we work a lot on the culture because I truly believe you have to do a person over player mindset. Otherwise, you know, a great player may not be the best person, and then that can, you know, maybe that one player can score goals, but if the, you know, nine behind them don't actually respect them and want to give them the ball, I bet those goals are harder to come by. So what we go is for the person first. And what we're, the big thing was with especially my first year girls was, you know, establishing what we were going to call our cornerstone of the program forever. And so we decided it was going to be belief. And we all had to believe in each other. We all had to believe that we can start something different. We all had to believe that, you know, we're starting a foundation that is going to, you know, boom in the future, and that there will never be another, you never have the opportunity to be another first year. You know what I mean? Like, so every one of these players were the start of something new. And then the mentality coming in for the newer players is, can you stick to this standard and then add something to it? Because as a player, you either add something, you subtract something, you multiply, or you divide. So you either bring them all together. You're a type of player that maybe athletically you can bring a certain level, but we can find 1,000 players that can bring something athletically. What can you bring personally to us? And then dividing, are you the player that creates a divide within the team? And obviously that's not what you want. What can you add, whether it's personally or athletically? And then do you subtract? So once again, is your personality going to fit, or are we going to have issues? And I think that that was our premium as we started. And, you know, by doing that, we've been able to really identify and attract some really good talent. So, for example, we have a girl that's, she's here with us this year, but she just wasn't eligible to play until next year. But she was a Division I transfer from Belmont University, and she was on a full ride there. She decided to come here. I don't exactly know what it was. I just know that we're happy to have her. She's a phenomenal person and even better player, which is rare. And so what we've done is try and just establish that piece. And every player that comes in, the first thing that they're told is, you know, we want to be the program that players want to join, not that we have to convince them. And so they know that straight away. And then the last question I always ask them, and even my players will ask them if they ever come visit the players or whatever, is, why should we want you? It's different because every player goes into a school thinking, oh yeah, this coach wants me. But the question is, why? Why should we want you? And that's a really hard one for them to answer. But I think I'm hitting on what you asked. It's just there's just a certain standard of that we set for each other and expectations. And I think during their visits to us and everything, it's all clear. I don't know how to explain it. And this is exactly what I tell the recruits. I can't really explain what we've managed to create here, but everyone that visits, they want to commit straight away. I just don't let them because I always, it's like a, you know, you go to church, all of a sudden you're the most religious person in the world, and then 2 days later you're back to your old way. So I want to make sure that euphoria of, yes, you enjoyed it, blah blah blah, I want to make sure you still have that excitement, you know, 2 or 3 days later, and then maybe we'll talk about it.
So we've gone this entire interview and it's been fascinating. There's so many trails we could go down, and we're scratching the surface on quite a few of them in terms of scouting, recruiting, two-year schools versus four-year schools, the arbitrage in the market in those areas. One of the things we've not gotten to that I want to ask you is, what is your personal coaching philosophy? How do you like to set your teams up to play, and how is that philosophy shaped by your overall expectations of your program in terms of some of the things you were just mentioning about culture, belief, playing together, connecting to one another, et cetera. So what is your playing philosophy, and how is that shaped by those overall principles that you try to run your program under?
So it all is shaped around trust. So every player, especially all your best players, say that they're a striker and attacking mid, or some of them are actually center backs, and that's good. But how many players, if you just look at your average player that goes to a Division I school as a striker, they end up playing fullback. They end up playing somewhere different. But that's because there's better players in those areas. So it's all built off trust. I will bring in players, but I tell them, obviously I think you're good, but you have to trust that I'm going to play you in the spot that you're going to flourish the most. And so my playing philosophy is all based on best decision making and defensive mindset. So I will find a way to score, but if we get scored on 100 times, it's not going to work. So defensively, we have to have a certain level of organization. So I need a type of player that's willing to listen. You may be the best player on the field, but if you're not listening, you're creating gaps that are. You can defend while you attack, and you can attack while you defend. And there's a fine line on how to do that. And so it's about trust that the players will believe in, what we've done before, how we're bringing to it. And so I don't know how to exactly answer it, because my personal philosophy is you want to create the well-rounded player that makes the right decisions. And how you do that is different from player to player, and how that goes from individual meetings to how you set up a session to everything. We want them to know decision-making skills. The only thing that I do not budge on is defensive principles. So we have to have a player that's willing to work back. If they're one of those strikers that's not willing to, that's an issue for me. So I guess those standards and expectations help set the philosophy just through, what their trust is in their players around them and everything else. But in terms of system of play and all that, I don't have one. You get your players and you figure out what fits them the best. So I might have recruited for a 4-2-3-1, which I did, but we ended up playing the first 4 or 5 games in a 3-4-1-2, and we're having massive success with it. It's just about trying to fit it. And what we realized was, against some of the better teams we play, it's really hard to cover the gaps for counterattacks. So we went back into our 4-2-3-1 and flourished again. Took another step forward. So it's, I make mistakes in terms of decisions, and they definitely make mistakes in terms of decisions on the field. But it's a matter of, I still trust them, they still trust me. And so those core principles, I guess they really are the philosophy. It's a matter of, the learning theory. Vygotsky's learning theory is really trial and error. And so everything we do, we have to trust that when we try something, we're not trying it just to try it. We're trying it because we believe it's the best decision. So if a player misses a pass in a game, the players around them are not allowed to be, I don't want to say not allowed, they're encouraged not to be too negative of it, because nobody's perfect. And, you can't give me a game that you made a perfect decision every time. So maybe it's possible your teammate messed up in their decision making, but the best players will help make that decision, that bad decision, better. So the question is, can you make your teammate look better? And if so, or program. If you can't make your teammate look better and it's about you, you're going to have a struggle.
So that's good. Right. That's good. So, as we kind of wrapping up here, I'm curious, when you're watching football on TV or in live matches, I know you're a Liverpool supporter. That's a great club to support. What are the managerial influences that you use in your management, whether that's, you know, your man management style, maybe it's, you know, some of your tactical philosophy? Where do you go for inspiration?
I love Pep and I love Klopp because they're both different. And I feel like if I can have the possession principles of Pep with the counter and defensive principles of Klopp, then you can't beat us. And so it's making the decision on is it time to play out or is it time to counter? Because sometimes City play a bit slower in the build-up, you know, to maintain numbers up, moving forward, and make creates fluidity, and that's great. But at the same time, they have to get expansive to do that, versus Liverpool have found a way to be expansive while still plugging the middle for stopping counters. So it's they're both very different, but they're similar in ways, but I think if you could combine the both tactics of both sides, you might have a team that's unstoppable. And so that's where, you know, I look a lot into that. In terms of, you know, the man managing piece, I had a bad coach at one point in my playing career, and I knew straight away I wouldn't be like him. That was my first rule for myself. And so my man management, you can't really see man management, especially at the professional level. I do a lot of ID camps, and I love to go and shadow coaches at a higher level. So I see how they work with them. But I'm also a nerd, and when I was in school, I did my master's thesis on the sport psychological aspect of sport and coaching. And, you know, you can be more authoritative with the more elite athlete, but you need to be more virtuous with some of the other ones. You don't need to be submissive. You need to be cooperative. You don't need to be an authoritarian. So I look at all the statistical things, and then, you know, I really question myself, where do I think I fit? And you just pick and choose your battles on, you know, I base everything I do off positivity, but it's you can also be demanding without being demeaning. So I think that there's a positive way to be demanding without, you know, while telling them, you don't always have to say, oh, it's all about fun, have it be perfect. They just have to, like I said, there's a certain level of trust you create that when you can give constructive criticism and they don't respond in a negative manner. And I think that that's my man managing style. Is my number one, first and foremost, is to learn the player. It used to be that the player is supposed to learn the coach and go off that. I truly don't believe that specifically with this generation. I think that the way to get the best out of them is to you learn the player. The players to learn their teammates. So I actually created some random game that I was up to, like, my assistants were laughing at me. I was up to like 2 a.m. because I wanted to create a game that asked some very deep questions in front of everyone of the whole team, where they had to write stuff on a note card. And then at the end of the note card, they had to put, who am I? And so when each player went up and read a note card, we had to try and guess whose card it was based upon the question. And what we were finding is we didn't know each other as well as we thought we did. So we were working on a way to create empathy. And I think that was our big piece to my man management style. Was one to learn the players, too, for the players to learn each other. And then we build off that. But in terms of tactics, Pep and Klopp, in terms of man management, it's different to every player. So I don't think you can't have a Sir Alex Ferguson style of management, because if you look back, you've got your Roy Keynes who absolutely can't stand him. So
in your Pep versus Klopp, and I love that answer there. Are you a fashionista like Pep? Or are you like, hey, I am going comfortable like Klopp?
Oh, dude, no, I'm comfortable. So, I wear the exact same stuff that the players do outside of, we have our coaching shorts and a shirt.
So from a fashion standpoint, you land on the Klopp scale. My next question is goal celebration. Are you Klopp running on the field celebrating with Allison, or are you Pep just doing a little fist pump going back to your chair?
I can't run on the field. I won't do that because then I'll get cards and whatnot. But, no, I'm very animated, so I'm just as happy as I'd say I'm a bit of both, because I can't leave the side. I know I can't leave the side. I will run on the sideline as long as it's not towards the other team's bench. But In terms of enthusiasm, I'm super passionate. I'm one of the ones that wear my heart on my sleeve. So, yeah, I'd say I'm similar to Klopp there, but at times with Pep, I think Pep's the same way as Klopp. I think they both are just as crazy. They both want to celebrate, and I think this time we've even seen Pep do something abnormal. You can't plan those things. You just win it. If it's a normal goal that you know you will respond a certain way, but then you have this weekend. I literally looked at the girl taking a free kick and said, "Hey, hit it top ends." And sure enough, she hit it off the top crossbar and it went in, and we all went mental. So you can't really plan those things.
Well, I look forward to seeing video of your sideline celebrations, and I'll do all I can to help them go viral. If you're as animated as you say you are on the sideline, my 8-year-old, he has perfected the Klopp goal celebration, the little staggered fist pump in the air thing. It's quite funny and kind of really iconic. And so I always get a good laugh when he goes celebrating a goal and pulling out the Jurgen Klopp goal celebration. So awesome. We'll definitely be checking Twitter and Instagram and other places to check out some of your goal celebrations and see if we can't help them go viral. So Colton, look, thanks for joining the show. Thanks for coming on the show. And I really, really do appreciate you kind of peeling the layers back on the onion and kind of talking about how you do what you do beyond just, you know, the tactical, like, you know, we played a game and here's what we looked at, X's and O's, but just to actually get into culture building, program building, finding players in the gaps, in the inefficiencies in the market, I really do think it was a lot of really good insight that you shared today, so I appreciate you coming on the show.
No problem, man. There's X's and O's, and then there's coaching. I'm working on a book that's called that, but I think X's and O's are one-fourth of it.
Well, I look forward to checking out that book when you get done with it. And like I said, I appreciate you coming on the show today. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. That is Colton Bryant. Really appreciate him coming on the show and sharing his thoughts and insights on his program there at Columbia State in Tennessee, but also just the market, coaching, culture building, etc. So speaking of culture building, check out Charity Water at charitywater.org. They are changing cultures by bringing clean drinking water to people all over the world, and you can be a part of that story at charitywater.org. We'll be right back after this.
No one, no man, no woman, no child should ever have to drink green water with bugs, with algae, with disease in it. Bad water and a lack of toilets kills more people than all the wars in the world. We know how to bring clean drinking water right now to every single person on earth. And when you can bring water into communities, it truly transforms them. It changes everything. Or you could know that you'd made a difference. You could know that you had truly impacted the life of a family, of a community, of a region. There was either clean water or there wasn't. We believe in a world where every single person has clean and safe water to drink, and we will continue fighting until that happens.
To thank Colton for coming on the show. Colton Bryant, head coach of Columbia State. He's not just a head coach. The guy's building a program from scratch. And to hear some of his insights and thoughts on that whole process was fascinating. And one of the things he brought up was an inefficiency in our scouting process here in American soccer. Everything has been channeled into one funnel, and that funnel is exclusive, it is elitist, and It is not based on finding the best. It's based on finding the best of what is available in that channel. And that is not always the case in terms of finding the best players. And it also means it's not always the case in terms of finding and providing opportunity and access to players. And our system, whether it's the U.S. Soccer Development Academy, which is administered by the Federation, or you have programs like the ECNL, which is the, you know, Elite Club National League, which is part of U.S. Club Soccer. These different programs are not necessarily indicative of giving every player in a country an opportunity. It is about just giving a few an opportunity in select markets. There are entire states without DA and ECNL. And if we have entire states, not cities, but entire states without that, there's no way that we can be saying we're trying to find our best. And if our scouts, both for the U.S. soccer youth national team programs, as well as for colleges and universities, are not exploring the talent outside of those areas, then we can't say we're really trying to do our best to find our best players. I've heard countless stories over the last several years of players who were not playing in those environments, who were told that in order to get scouted, in order for us to consider you for our youth national team, you have to get into a DA. If you keep playing where you are, we're not going to call you in anymore. We're not going to bring you in anymore. We're not going to look at you anymore. If the player was good enough to get your attention in the first place without the DA, to make that a requirement of a family who may not even live within an area of a DA is absurd. You know, I had Chris Richards' dad, Ken, on the show a few months ago. Ken and his family are from the Birmingham, Alabama area. And Chris grew up playing in the Birmingham area. And they realized that the level of competition wasn't as good as it could be. And they were really hoping for an opportunity for him to get more exposure. That required them to send Chris to live with a host family in Houston, Texas. And then from there, he got some opportunities in Dallas. And then from Dallas, he eventually made his way to Bayern Munich. In a country like the United States, it's one thing to say, okay, I'm from a small town in the middle of nowhere. I'm a really, really good player. And there's just no way to get any kind of infrastructure around that player where they live locally. I understand that. Birmingham, Alabama is a city of in a metro market of over a million people. To not have the ability to have the club infrastructure in an area like that to support a player is absurd. When you look at countries around the world and the players that they're putting out and the level of that talent, we are not doing the soccer part the right way. And there is a giant arbitrage in the market, as Colton pointed out, in the way that he's having to go out and find players that are not getting opportunities to get seen and scouted just because they're not playing in ECNL or DA. And we need to reevaluate how we do what we do, especially when it comes to scouting. So I really do appreciate Colton coming on the show and sharing his ideas. Thanks for watching the show. You can watch every day at facebook.com/WRKMN or at danielworkman.com. You can check me out on Twitter or Instagram at Daniel Workman. I want to leave you with this thought. It was one of the thoughts I talked about yesterday on the show, and it was on the tweet thread, but it's something that I believe is a core belief of mine. I believe that American soccer could be, and I think should be, the greatest soccer country on earth. It is our federation that is getting in the way of that, but we could be and should be so much better. And I hope that you will take some time out of your day to figure out a way that you can help make American soccer better right where you are. Thanks for joining the show. We'll see you again tomorrow.